In what follows from Albert O. Hirschman's The Passions and the Interests, Political Arguments for Capitalism Before Its Triumph, consider the turn of thought wrought by his argument. Quote, "But the idea that men pursuing their interests would be forever harmless was decisively given up only when the reality of capitalist development was in full view. As economic growth in the 19th and 20th centuries uprooted millions of people, impoverished numerous groups while enriching some, caused large-scale unemployment during cyclical depressions, and produced modern mass society, it became clear to a number of observers that those caught in these violent transformations would on occasion become passionate, passionately angry, fearful, resentful. There is no need to list here the names of those social scientists who recorded these developments and analyzed them under the terms of alienation, ennemi, resentment, vermasson, class struggle, and many others. It is precisely because we are under the influence of these analyses, and even more under the impact of cataclysmic events which we try to understand with their help, that the doctrine reviewed here has an air of unreality about it, and on superficial acquaintance appears not to deserve to be taken seriously. It is precisely because it strikes the contemporary mind as odd that it can throw some light on the still puzzling ideological circumstances of the rise of capitalism. An obvious way of entering into this topic is to compare the account of the emergence of money-making as an honored occupation that has been presented in this way with Weber's thesis on the Protestant ethic and with a debate around it. As was noted repeatedly in the previous pages, the expansion of commerce and industry in the 17th and 18th centuries has been viewed here as being welcomed and promoted not by some marginal social groups, nor by an insurgent ideology, but by a current of opinion that arose right in the center of the power structure and the establishment of the time, out of the problems with which the prince, and particularly his advisors and other concerned notables, were grappling. There we have it, folks. This is a suppressed book. His argument, his analysis, his serious delving into this question is invaluable for us. Continuing. Out of the problems with which the prince, and particularly his advisors and other concerned notables, those abandoned children who grew up, you know, in those monasteries, you know, that very literate bunch who at age 10 were alienated from their royal and elite families, who therefore harbored deep feelings of not being appreciated and seen, or being not good enough, perhaps, and needing to prove that by serving who? The king. That was that task of childhood they never completed. Their need to prove they really were good enough, after all. So these were the other concerned notables, the advisors to the prince. Ever since the end, continuing, ever since the end of the Middle Ages, and particularly as a result of the increasing frequency of war and civil war in the 17th and 18th centuries, the search was on for a behavioral equivalent for religious precept, for new rules of conduct and devices that would impose much-needed discipline and constraints on both rulers and ruled. And the expansion, I'm sorry, every time I read that, I'm thinking, this is probably not appropriate, but the image that comes to mind those images of the earth connected that I read in George Eliot's Adam Bede, the lovingness, the centeredness, the steadiness, and the notion of those folk being viciously violent toward each other. Or the image in Seven Samurai of the peasants trying to figure out what to do with these, you know, these vicious attacks of these marauding pirates, you know, not pirates, but you know what I'm saying, bandits. You know, we earth connected. The earth is has a gentling effect. When you spend time with it, you start to see that it has many, many lessons, and that becomes interesting. We are these intellectual beings, and far from those, we who are earth connected, not having a vital and energetic and invigorating intellectual life. Just the opposite. Just the opposite. It is those who have been abandoned and so deeply damaged, whose thought has atrophied. They're stuck in that same project that they got saddled with when they were set on that road or on the monastery steps. So continuing with Hirschman. So my point being is that much needed discipline on both rulers and ruled, not so much for we ruled, you know, until they set about trying to sculpt us in their image, and unfortunately have had some effect. And they saw that the expansion, Hirschman's here, of commerce and industry as having promise in this regard to rein in those passions of the kings and their greed. Weber and his followers, as well as most of his critics, were primarily interested in the psychological processes through which some groups of men become single-minded in the rational pursuit of capitalist accumulation. My story takes it for granted that some men became so impelled and focuses instead on the reaction to the new phenomenon by what is called today the intellectual, managerial, and administrative elite. That reaction was favorable, not because the money-making activities were approved in themselves, but because they were thought to have a most beneficial side effect. They kept the men who were engaged in them out of mischief, quote-unquote, as it were, and had, more specifically, the virtue of imposing restraints on princely caprice, arbitrary government, and adventurous foreign policies. And my comment, here we have another suppressed book, as with Hirschman's and Popper's help. Had their words been discussed by we commoners, we would long since have seen the flaws in Marxism as an ideological tool to assist in our mobilization for freedom. And clearly, these Plato's tribesmen see themselves as the opposite of mischief makers and therefore entitled to rule us. To see this is false. We need only look around us. Look at the mess they've made of our common earth.